Coming up on Fronteras, for decades, millions of undocumented immigrants have lived in hiding. Now a small group is opening up about their status. The undocumented and unafraid movement and what they're trying to achieve. Also, the Latino vote increased nationwide this election, but the impact of the Latino electorate varied among states.
People say we're the sleeping giant. Here in Arizona, we're the ignored giant because we haven't seen the resources or the time being put by both political parties or candidates to turn out Latinos.
We compare the Latino vote in Nevada versus Arizona, but first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among seven public radio stations and funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as part of its local Journalism Center initiative. I'm Crystal Chavez. About 30 million people in seven western states and two Mexican states depend on Colorado River water. After years of negotiations, the U.S. and Mexico have signed a landmark water use agreement. From the Changing America desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales has the story.
As this 1955 educational video explains, the Hoover Dam was built to control the powerful Colorado River, which for many years flooded farms and cities.
Millions come to this once desolate spot to hear the story of Hoover Dam.
Ladies and gentlemen, here is where man conquered this mighty river, placing a concrete yoke about its neck to harness its tremendous water and power resources.
In 1922, the Colorado River Compact divvied up the water to the upper and lower basin states. This allowed for cities like Las Vegas and San Diego to mushroom rapidly, and for farmers to grow acre upon acre of alfalfa and other crops. About 20 years later, Arizona and Mexico signed on to receive their shares. So let's do a little math. Water is measured in acre feet. An acre foot is enough water for about two households a year. 7.5 million acre feet was allocated to the upper basin states, the same to the lower basin. 1.5 million acre feet to Mexico. Add in the loss to evaporation, remember, we're in the desert here, and you get a grand total of about 18 million acre feet a year. But today, in this extended drought period, the river is flowing at best 15 million acre feet.
There just simply isn't enough water to go around, even if we drain the river dry every year, to satisfy those who have legal rights to the water.
The University of Arizona's Robert Glennon is the author of Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. In addition to the over-allocation of river water, the states are now facing climate change and population growth.
You add all of those things up, and it's a train wreck. So the states and the two national governments cannot put their heads in the sand and pretend that there's not a problem. And I commend them for tackling the issue head-on.
The issue came to a head 5 years ago when Lake Mead, the reservoir behind Hoover Dam, reached a critical low point. The western states devised a backup plan, but the real question, will Mexico go along? David Modier is the general manager of the Central Arizona Project, which provides most of the state's water.
That's a uncertainty and a threat to us that if we were going to have to cut back supplies, there was no guarantee that the amount of water that Mexico gets on an annual basis would be reduced similarly in fashion.
There was an added urgency to the negotiations for Mexico when, in 2010, an earthquake damaged pipelines in a major farming area south of the border. Mexico asked the U.S. to let it store water in Lake Mead while repairs were made. The new water agreement extends this emergency storage program. It's a precedent-setting agreement, and many other nations dealing with water scarcity, like Australia and some Asian countries, are watching with interest. Pat Mulroy is the general manager of the Southern Nevada Water Authority.
Just the notion that one country would use its facilities to store the waters of another country is a huge issue across the globe. And this agreement will go down as a blueprint.
The agreement also has some gains for environmentalists. It calls for a pilot program of water releases from the U.S. to replenish the now mostly dry wetlands in the Colorado River Delta in northern Mexico, once a major stopover for North American birds. But the most important element of this agreement is that Mexico will share in times of surplus and shortage with the western United States. Still, water experts say more needs to be done to plan for climate change, which will likely reduce Colorado River flows by as much as 9%. I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
In both Nevada and Arizona, exit polls show Latino voters represented just under 20% of the electorate in the November 6th election. It's likely that the final tally will conclude a record Latino turnout in both states. In Nevada, Latino voters ultimately swung the election, again for President Obama. While in Arizona, Latinos had less of a decisive impact. The Fronteras desk took a look at how Latino voters were activated in those states. Let's begin with Veronica Zaragovia in Las Vegas.
On the evening before Election Day, Jorge Garcia went door to door in a neighborhood just west of the Las Vegas Strip. After 40 minutes, Garcia, a culinary union worker and a vote canvasser, finally makes contact with Juan and Luis Wong. For several months before the election, the union sent workers like Jorge Garcia into the community to get out the vote in Spanish.
Voting is very important, Garcia tells him. If you don't vote, others will decide for you.
Unions, Democratic Party volunteers, and nonpartisan groups pushed a massive Get Out the Vote campaign in Nevada. It began months ago and resulted in record-setting turnout among Latino voters here.
We have just built a methodical infrastructure to turn out and educate Latinos to vote.
Andres Ramirez is a Democratic Party consultant in Nevada. He's worked on campaigns here since 1998.
You couldn't watch novelas without watching political advertisements. You couldn't turn on the radio without listening to political advertisements. You couldn't open your mailbox without having direct mail sent to you. You were getting door knocks. You were getting phone calls. It was a very intense effort.
He says Latinos played a decisive role here in the last few election cycles.
Latinos delivered for Obama in 2008. They delivered for Reid in 2010, and they delivered for Obama again in 2012. This has now been a steady trend, actually beginning since 1996 in the state of Nevada.
Ramirez gives credit to Nevada Senator Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader. Nearly a decade ago, Reid set about building a ground game with Latino voters for the Democratic Party, a ground game that got a lot of support this year from the National Democratic Party and political PACs who poured millions into state campaigns here. In Las Vegas, I'm Veronica Zaragovia.
I'm Jude Jaffe Block in Phoenix. Here in Arizona, more than three-quarters of Latino voters supported President Obama, according to exit polls. That's actually a higher rate than in Nevada. But little fuss has been made about that fact since Mitt Romney won this red state so decisively. Kantar Media found that campaigns here only spent a third of what they spent in Nevada on Spanish-language TV ads.
People say we're the sleeping giant. Here in Arizona, we're the ignored giant.
Francisco Heredia is the Arizona director for Mi Familia Vota, a nonpartisan Latino civic group. And he's a little jealous of the Silver State.
We haven't seen the resources or the time being put by both political parties or candidates to turn out Latinos.
Instead, that task was left to several grassroots organizations. Before the election, these groups celebrated boosting Latino registrations to record numbers.
And right now, we're all going to go out and get more people registered to vote.
Many activists hoped a record Latino voter turnout would unseat immigration hardliner Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio and elect Democratic Latino candidate Rich Carmona to the Senate. While neither race went that way, Democrats lost by a much smaller margin than in recent years.
Aside from the actual who won or lost, I think that the Latino vote flexed its muscles in Arizona this year in a way that it hasn't in years past.
Ethan Axelrod is with Project New America, a strategy firm for progressive candidates. When it comes to the Arizona Senate race, the Democrat lost, but he still had very strong Latino support. And Axelrod says that should make Republicans worried.
It's the fact that they voted overwhelmingly for Democrats, which really hasn't been the case in Arizona as much as in a state like Nevada in the past.
That's one factor that keeps strategists like Axelrod believing it's only a matter of time before the Grand Canyon state becomes a battleground. In Phoenix, I'm Jude Joffe Block.
There's still more Fronteras coming up. For decades, millions of undocumented immigrants have lived in hiding, and now small groups opening up. We'll hear about the undocumented and unafraid movement. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. An estimated 11.5 million undocumented immigrants live in the United States, and most of them live in hiding. But now a small group of mostly young people are opening up about their status. They admit and sometimes shout that they are undocumented and unafraid. From the Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
Oftentimes, undocumented people I've interviewed have chosen to use fake names, like this man who spoke to me through a translator after a series of immigration and customs enforcement raids in Flagstaff 4 years ago.
There was one night where we didn't have anything for dinner, and so I had to go out to the store to go buy groceries so we could make dinner. And my four-year-old daughter asked me, "Dad, where are you going? Don't go, because La Migra, the immigration, is out, and they might get you. There's some cereal right there. Don't worry, we can eat cereal. Just don't go." "Papi, no te preocupes.
Nosotros podemos cenar cereal." 24-year-old Alexandra Samarón once felt that way, too. Samarón came to the U.S. with her mom when she was 16 to leave her abusive father and start a new life.
"We were really afraid, so I'm telling you, like, we were really afraid."
Something changed for Samarón last summer when she was asked to participate in a demonstration outside an immigration detention center in Los Angeles. It was the day President Obama announced a two-year reprieve from deportation for young immigrants who came to the U.S. before the age of 16.
"We were sitting in the street, and we were shouting, 'I am undocumented and I'm unafraid.'" And that was very empowering because just like saying it out loud, it helps you and it gives you power.
This mantra has become the rallying cry for the undocumented around the nation. Here it is last year at a protest in Georgia.
Each time I said it, it seemed that I was saying it louder. And it gives you a sense of being proud.
Over the last few years, the debate over immigration reform has gotten louder. Protests have been spurred by Arizona's SB 1070, or Show Me Your Papers law. About the same time, young immigrants also rallied, marched, and held hunger strikes for a federal DREAM Act. The legislation would have provided a path to citizenship for college students who came to the U.S. as children. The Unafraid movement grew out of desperation when the DREAM Act failed in Congress. These students say deferred action isn't enough. Today they're fighting for something much bigger, respect for the whole immigration community. Young immigrants across the country are coming out in places that draw attention, outside state capitol buildings, immigration courts, even inside ICE offices. So far, activists say arrests have been made during these acts of civil disobedience, but no one has been deported.
"I think the risk is really low."
Matt Poirier is an attorney specializing in immigration law in Flagstaff.
"The executive branch of the government, they've placed an extremely low priority on the removal of young immigrants who do not have any criminal history. But there's still a law in place that says that if you're here without permission, you're subject to removal."
Poirier says undocumented immigrants with a criminal record, especially one that's violent or involves drugs, are taking a great risk. With or without a rap sheet, the vast majority are still keeping their status a secret. Alexandra Samarón's record is clean, but she still has her mom to contend with.
I don't know. She's always telling me, Alexandra, when are you going to stop helping people and just help yourself? So sometimes she gets really bothered about that. My community is what keeps me going.
Samaron says she's chosen to come out about her status for her mother, who she says shouldn't feel guilty for bringing her to the United States. I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
Thanksgiving is a time of sharing, not just the sharing of our bounty with the less fortunate, but also the sharing of stories, particularly the sharing of old family stories. It's these tales of past generation Thanksgiving celebrations that can provide the context needed to truly be thankful today, and also provide the rich loam for family roots to dig deep into. That's what Texas Public Radio's Yvette Benavidez reveals in her commentary. She remembers her childhood Thanksgivings in Laredo.
My father was a marksman. For years, he was a member of the Laredo Rifle and Pistol Club. The group would convene at the shooting range on the outskirts of town every Sunday morning for various competitions. My father hunted on occasion, but it was the target shooting that appealed to him. Sunday rituals for the rest of the family involved going to Mass. My father would return from the range around lunchtime with a first-place ribbon or trophy for the day's competition. These awards started out in a beautiful showcase. Eventually, though, they were so numerous, they were stored away in boxes in my father's workshop. Targets with bullseyes bored through dead center were on display there, where he toiled for hours, cleaning his weapons and even making his own ammunition, an impossibly tedious, exacting, and meticulous kind of work, requiring the steadiness of a surgeon's hands, the math skills of a chemist, and the solitude of a hermit. The ribbons and trophies meant my father was a man with incredible aim and a good eye. He was also quite disciplined and practiced a lot. All of his friends from the club knew that. I used to wonder why they kept meeting Sunday after Sunday, knowing that my dad would win. On those rare days when my father came home with a second-place ribbon or, incredibly, a third-place showing, I felt a little disappointed and suspected my dad let someone else win for a change to keep things interesting. In November, the stakes were a little higher. The club sponsored a turkey shoot. This wasn't the kind of turkey shoot depicted in the movie classic Sergeant York, where men go out into the woods and shoot and kill actual unfortunate turkeys walking around among them, Gary Cooper's turkey warble bird call at once beckoning the bird and heralding his perfect aim. This was another marksman contest. The men shot at targets. The winning score for each round in the tournament earned a gift coupon good for one turkey from the HEB. My dad would come home with enough winning tickets to keep my mom's upright freezer in the back porch stocked with the rock-hard frozen birds. Eventually, my father stopped going to the rifle range. His old friends had stopped attending, and a new bunch of young, reckless, foul-mouthed soda can killers replaced my dad's peers. Another chapter of my family's life tells the emotional story of my father returning to church after a very long spell of sitting it out. Sundays would be reserved for Mass with the family for the rest of my father's life. My mother has since joined the seasonal throng of humanity at the grocery store on the hunt for the Thanksgiving Day turkey, a different kind of pitched battle to see who scores the win and still gets home with some modicum of goodwill toward man intact. My mother recalls that her mother and seven brothers and sisters struggled mightily to get food on the table most days, let alone on Thanksgiving. She tells me that when she was a little girl, a duck roamed the backyard of the family's small house in Laredo. One Thanksgiving, the family sat down to a feast of tamales. Where had the meat come from? That was the day the duck mysteriously disappeared. She also tells me, still with eyes wide and shining in awe, about the time an elementary school teacher raffled off the class Christmas tree. Her brother, my tío Miguel, was the winner of the tree. The children dragged it home, immediately banishing the Charlie Brown branch that sat forlornly in the small living room, out to the curb to make room for the prized Tannenbaum, which they jubilantly decorated with construction paper creations and tinsel. By contrast, my father's childhood was a lonely one. His mother died when he was 7. His father fretted over my father's brother, who was severely autistic. There weren't many Thanksgiving dinners my father could recall growing up in his sad house. How thorny and testing life can be. As children, my folks couldn't control the arduous nature of their lives, but as adults, they sought out a little more control of their destinies. My father was a highly disciplined man. His single-minded focus was surpassed only by his industriousness. He freed himself from his lonely childhood and surrounded himself with a large family and with my mother, who was as unremittingly tireless as my father in her work. Everything my father did, including the turkey shoot, was for the family. Sitting down to our Thanksgiving meal, I always sensed my father's pride over supplying the turkey. There was something so primordial and elemental about his providing the roast beast. When we sat down for the meal, he watched for our reactions as we ate and asked how we liked it, as if he had cooked the turkey himself. Life gave me a fairer hand than my folks got. How blessed I've been never to want for anything, and yet to be able to understand life's tough lessons by familial association, my parents' shining example. I'm blessed to know that being truly grateful means sharing with others. That aim is true. Everybody wins.
That commentary was from Texas Public Radio's Yvette Benavides. You've been listening to Fronteras, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting-funded journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. Fronteras is online at fronterasdesk.org. We're also on Facebook, and we invite you to join the conversations there about our stories. And for headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. The handle is fronterasdesk. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Our theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.